the end of the Reagan era. I'm like Lemma 12er, old enough to understand that shit had changed forever. They declared a war on drugs, like a war on terror. But what it really did was let the police terrorize whoever. But mostly black boys, but they would call us niggas and lay us on our belly while they fingers on their triggers. They boots was on our head, they dolls was on our crotches. And they would beat us up if we had diamonds on our watches. And they would take our drugs and monies as they pick our pockets. I guess that's the privilege of policing for some profit. But thanks to Reaganomics, prison turned to profits. Cause free labor's the cornerstone of U.S. economics. Cause slavery was abolished unless you are in prison. You think I am bullshitting, then read the 13th Amendment. Involuntary servitude and slavery, it prohibits. That's why they giving drug offenders time in double digits.
Hello, and I want to welcome everyone to another episode of Bourbon in Browntown. I am your host, David of Browntown, and I am joined by my fabulous co-host, Colin of Browntown. Colin, what are we drinking today?
We're going back to our college days with this one. Have a little Jack Daniel Tennessee whiskey.
Hey, a little ginger. We've kind of seen over the last few weeks a little bit more than often, because it's been around for a moment, and we'll kind of get to that. But this sort of call or sort of like surprise of this opioid epidemic, and the way that it's been treated, you know, as a crisis. This is sort of like
sure.
People need to understand and realize, like, hey, these people need treatment, and then, you know, they're addicted, and woo. And something that we at Bourbon and Browntown were discussing at what moment is kind of realizing that, as much as people don't like to say, race influences this subject and has more than a few others. And the point of that we're trying to make is this conversation of, you know, drug use, it's treatment versus it's criminalization.
We're going to look at one of the major causes of this crisis, prescription painkillers, which are chemical cousins of heroin. Around 75% of heroin users started with a prescription opioid, drugs like OxyContin, Vicodin, and Percocet, which some take recreationally and others take as prescribed by a doctor.
So what can be done? There are many variables, but any solution would require controlling the distribution of prescription opioids, expanding access to medication-assisted treatment, and making naloxone an overdose antidote more accessible. In addition, more controversial ideas like drug checking services or supervised injection sites may be necessary to slow the rise in overdose deaths.
It's great that this opioid crisis is being treated like a public health issue, and that there are efforts to put into treatment and not criminalization, but there's still a fucking problem with that. And it's very much that, like, one, where was this type of, you know, response for other drugs? And then sort of two, looking at big pharma and doctors and kind of really diving into what the hell that really even means.
Yeah, I mean, I think what it means is white bodies and white people are more important than black and brown people, to be honest.
Yeah.
One of those things where it's like, it's for me at least, how I kind of came to the analysis I have on a lot of things, kind of came into consciousness myself, was, for one, you know, studying, looking at the Black Panthers and Black liberation movements in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But for two, was looking at the war on drugs and how that influenced mass incarceration, kind of before it became hip to talk about the war on drugs, right? And so this kind of issue, and looking at the war on drugs and crack and cocaine in the 80s and how that influenced the image of the black male and black people as savages up until, you know, today and still continues, looking at that and contrasting and pairing that to the opioid crisis in Appalachian cities and kind of in, you know, rural white America. Mm-hmm. It frustrates me because we're not treated the same, right?
Yeah.
In the 80s, it was this image of you know, the crack whore and people selling crack cocaine and stuff was looked at as savagery and bad and
evil.
Let's lock up all these people.
The devil.
They're criminals. They're rapists and murderers. And then now it's looking at the opioid crisis and people, you know, not having opioids available to them, using heroin in these communities. And it being a sad thing that it is a public health issue, but it was in the 80s as well with black people. But we were criminalized and locked up then, whereas white people are getting treatment, and there's not enough, but some legislation going towards it now, and it's just the framing of it is radically different. And to say it's not built in capitalism and white supremacy is just not true. So it frustrates me on a personal level because that's not fair and equitable, but also there's a special place in my heart for the war on drugs because it awoken me to a lot of things, and the fact that this is not seen the same way is good because we're helping people in this more comprehensive way of dealing with a real public health issue. But at the same time, it's like, why aren't we treated like that? Why have we now spent trillions of dollars in the war on drugs, which could have went to these communities and inner city communities and really helped all poor people, and not further the divide, the racial divide between black and brown poor people, and not give them a chance to have a seat at the table and really deconstruct a moneyed, hegemonic culture and power structure that really demonizes and disenfranchises both.
And so the conversation that we're trying to create is being able to see and understand the difference in responses, right?
Sure.
And so as you said, this sort of the war on drugs and you being able to look at it from a distance, because I think if maybe, you know, we were in that space or that time, like, we would not have the ability to do so. And so the fact that we do, and the fact that it was able to hit you so personally, we also try to offer multiple sides to everything. And so we are glad that we are not upset that we have people being treated, but we want to, for everyone to understand that was not the case just 20, 30 years ago. And why the change now? Why the change of heart? Why now do we look at addiction as an actual health issue than just, oh, that's just what they are, that it's just what they do, that's just how they live and live. And then the second point, which we'll dive a little bit more into, is really what big pharma is, how you know these drugs are able to be sort of distributed and handed out, and how this sort of came about, and you know how there's always multiple enemies that we're fighting at once, and it's not just you know, just one thing. It's always just trying to highlight these things for ourselves. And so we're looking at this treatment versus this criminalization. You know, of all deaths in 2015 from opioids and heroin overdoses nationwide, about 90% of the people were white. You know, black people accounted for little more than 8%. And so we immediately see what type of demographic this is hitting, right?
Absolutely.
And it's predominantly white. You know, but and we look back to the crack epidemic, and the majority of the demographic was African Americans.
Yeah.
You know, and in specific spaces in the nation.
Yeah. And even then, you can look at even. I mean, we could do a whole, you know, series of podcasts on the war on drugs, especially in the 80s, because, you know, it started, you know, with Nixon in the 70s and stuff, and got ramped up in the 80s under Reagan and certain policies, that he got passed, notably got passed with a majority Democratic House as well. So as much as I love to just blast Reagan this entire episode, you know, this is Reagan in the state . This is Reagan, really, this is, you know, Bush, of course, after him, and Clinton as well in the 90s, in this hard on, tough on crime mantra that they all kind of permeated and really permeated into policy. So, you know, fuck Reagan, but fuck Bush and fuck Clinton at the same time. As far as welfare reform in the 90s, as far as the 86 drug bill, all these things, mandatory minimums. And just looking at that 20-year period, you know, 80 to 2000, and looking at not only with policy and certain things that, you know, criminalize crack cocaine over powder cocaine, which you can essentially make more powder cocaine or crack cocaine with the same amount of powder cocaine. So just looking at this logic of how they criminalize drugs didn't, like, make any sense, and how you know, you can get arrested for more time with crack cocaine than powder cocaine. really all that's like that itself was racialized.
Yep.
Right. That itself is, and then that being sustained by other policies, like I mentioned, with mandatory minimums, as well as welfare policy under Clinton, and so on and so forth. All those things are racialized. So we have this public policy, which is making all these very structural things and really exacerbating the mass incarceration, mass racialized incarceration. Then we have a buzzword I like to always use, how that's affecting mass consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And we see Nancy Reagan would just say no, as far as like drugs is an individual cultural problem, not a systemic problem, right?
Yeah.
We have her doing PSAs. We have Pee Wee Herman doing PSAs. Mm-hmm. We have these, this is your brain on drugs, PSA. Always like, drugs are bad, drugs are bad, drugs are bad. We have all that, and then now we have legal drugs, like opioids for back pain and for things like that, and painkillers for coal miners who are like an Appalachian country and need these things. And so with that, it starts out with legal drugs, and then folks don't get it anymore, so they get addicted, they get overprescribed, and then a sidebar to that, they don't really want to prescribe black people as much because they think they're going to go out and sell them. So all that's to say is how we talk about drugs, even saying the war on drugs, is super, super simple and super, super binary, right?
Yeah.
This makes us think that drugs are bad, but then we say, oh, but what about Tylenol? What about Advil? Oh, no, those are good.
NyQuil.
Okay, so why are they good? Oh, because, like, they're legal. Okay, why are they legal? These are all this, humans made them legal, and these are regulated. Wait, let me look at the regulation and how Big Pharma, that's just sort of like big pharmaceutical companies, in my view, are just, illegal drug cartel. Yeah. Especially when you look at how, they're in bed with politicians and how that helped them get in the hospitals more and got people prescribed in the first place and overprescribed. And so all that being a problem and being able – and Big Pharma being able to lobby politicians to almost literally write drug laws.
Yeah. No, and it's incredible. Over the last 10 years, total pharmaceutical health products have been $208 million a year. And that's money that's gone into lobbying for pharma and health products. It's interesting that we're talking about the legalization of things, is because like one of the most recent things is marijuana, cannabis.
Sure.
We have people who were selling cannabis 10 years ago, getting arrested, getting sentenced for, 20 years. And now this shit is legal. And so then you have another group of people selling something that all of a sudden became legal. And it's okay to be making the same money that they were making. And yet you still have all these other people who are like in jail and there's no way for them to get out.
It's like, shouldn't I be able to get out?
Like, is legal now? Like, am I good? Like, I didn't even have that much. Like, that is like... But someone was trying to explain to me why, like, when things like that happen, like, you can't actually fight to get out of jail. Like, if I was in jail for selling drugs, like, I got caught with, I don't fucking know.
Some Tylenol?
Pounds of marijuana. And then I get sent to jail. And then 10 years later, this shit becomes legal. And big companies are, like, selling this shit. Like, they make gummy bears now out of this shit. They have pens. The market has opened for cannabis just because someone made it legal, right? And so, sure, I did when I was when it was illegal. But like, why am I still going to spend 15 years more in jail when everyone else is fucking doing it now and it's okay? That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
But like, someone tried to explain to me the rule behind that, or like you're like grandfathered into.
And it's shitty, right? And it's like,
that's a problem that you look at into our prison system, which is as we always say, everything's always tied to something, and we always bring it back to. Capitalism and its effects, and we're looking at Big Pharma. We're looking at the way that it has influenced lobbying, into politics, Chicago, and like other major cities, and the way in which also the government and media kind of use this colorblind or race neutral language to paint things in different lights, we've seen. During the Reagan era, how he hired people to help publicize the emergence of crack cocaine in the 80s as a strategic effort to build public and legislative support for the war on drugs. And this is part of the New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, which I know I have not read. Have you?
That's a great question. I've read excerpts of the New Jim Crow. I have not read it cover to cover.
Okay.
However, with the New Jim Crow and with 13th, the documentary on the mass incarceration,
yeah,
I've not watched and read either of those book or movies in their entirety.
Yeah.
I've heard they're great. I'm sure they are. I've referenced New Jim Crow in like academic papers, things like that. Here's the thing. I'm glad they've been made. I'm glad they're out in the mainstream. And I'm glad people have read them and kind of been aware of these things and now are, again, like mass incarceration is like the thing to be mad about and protest against and act against in activist circles and electoral politics everywhere. I'm glad all these things are happening. This shit is nothing new. Like, I've been, like, reading and learning about and been involved in mass incarceration, how that affects me as a black body in this world, for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there's always this like hipsterization when it comes to that mm-hmm. book and that movie. So you talk to, you know, black people and just people in general who've known about this and studied this and been in the streets acting against this for a very long time. It's kind of twofold. It's like, on one hand, you're glad folks are mad about it and you're glad things are finally kind of changing and really the narrative is changing about these things. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing a lot of that across the board, which is good. But also, you're like, damn, like, where is all this 10, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, I mean, and like, who's to say, like, why shouldn't happen or why didn't hit the fan? But, I mean, what that does for us is only puts us in a more crucial moment.
Absolutely.
You know, in our society and in our culture. And this is why you see, you know, as we spoke about in previous episodes of this this grassroots resurgence of organizations and activists kind of moving forward and pushing for change. And I think, like, yeah, I totally feel you that you get, like, upset and, like, you know, you're like, man, these fucking hipsters, let's just call them that.
I'm saying I'm the hipster in this situation. I'm like, oh, I knew about mass incarceration before it was cool. You know what I mean? But at the same time, you're like, no,
it's
like,
hilarious.
You know, people are being aware of this. How do you harness that energy and that, and that, you know, really mass consciousness in a good way around how this is a very structural and, like, issue and how this permeates white supremacy? How do you use that to actually affect change in the different avenues that you can? So in this situation, I'm the hipster. I'm the one that's like, oh,
that's hilarious.
I knew about this before it was cool to be an activist. Before it was activist chic, right? But it's like, you know, it's twofold. You want to use that, but also bring people. You know, you want to radicalize. People have been radicalized. Awesome. Sit them down. We have snacks in the corner. Yeah. Welcome to the gang. Here's how we're fighting the system. And here are other intersections of problems that are related to this.
Yeah, and how it all...
How mass incarceration is related to capitalism. How it's related to white supremacy, obviously. How it's related to the patriarchy. How it's related to all these things and what we do. How do we, you know, mobilize people to fight it. So again, it is good. And I can check myself. But it's just like, people are like, oh, you haven't read New Jim Crow? It's like, I've known about the New Jim Crow.
Yeah.
Not only do I live it, but like, I've actively sought out other literature and other people who have been writing and speaking about this for years.
For a while now.
When it wasn't cool. I remember a couple years ago when I was talking to friends about something, and I kept saying, like, you know, this is white supremacy. This is a, you know, this is a white supremacist law. This policy instills white supremacy on it in a broad way. And like, I think that's becoming a term people are understanding more.
Yeah.
But before, I mean, I'm just saying, just a few years ago, it was like, oh, you say white supremacist, It's like, oh, KKK, Nazis. And it's like,
yeah,
that too. Yeah, they are. But you know, colorblind drug laws. So are colorblind housing laws. Yeah. All these things permeate white supremacy mm-hmm. and permeate an idea that, you know, black bodies are disposable. And now we got to a point where the disposable population has moved from black and brown bodies to poor white people. It's become a problem.
Yep.
Right. And again, it's one of those things where it's like, you don't want to say, oh, like, criminalize, lock them up as well. It's like, no, it being an actual public crisis and needs to be money and legislation put towards it and understanding the problem needs to be addressed. But we need to address what was happening in the 80s and until now as well with black and brown bodies, and obviously before then too. And it's like, how do you correct that? And really beyond that, it's something I haven't really heard that much about. I could be just not as informed, but I think it's well documented now how Big Pharma has been in bed with legislators, mm-hmm. and how money lobbyists really influenced opioids to be overprescribed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no one's in jail for that. No one's being held accountable for that, in part because it's all legal. So how do we rewrite those laws so this doesn't happen again in a very structural way? But that disrupts the natural order of capitalism and how capitalism and, yeah. and you know, companies and really other corporations, other cartels yeah. are in bed with legislators. So how yeah. do we deal with that?
And I do think a part of it, though, is like, how many people are actually informed enough to understand sure. the steps necessary in order to destroy that system, that sort of like sure. Big Pharma attitude. You know, we're looking at multi-million, maybe even billion-dollar companies. Absolutely. It's like, how do you bring any change on that? Like, how do you go about doing it? And so it's really first and foremost understanding the problem at large, realizing how it is that it affects other people. Because many times it's like, for example, personally, I don't have anyone who is like on opioids. I mean, at least that I'm aware of, right?
My wrist.
Like, you know, or like have gone to the point of doing heroin or whatever sure. that's been going on. And so, but because I don't see that, it doesn't mean that it's not a problem.
Yeah.
Just with other things. Yeah.
And here's the thing I'll kind of say with that. It's like, yeah, I can say the same thing for myself or yeah. anyone at least close to me who, you know, was doing crack or doing cocaine, anything like that. However, And one thing that you hear from folks kind of in these communities kind of before the opioid crisis came to the forefront was like, oh, I'm hearing about mass incarceration now, how like, you know, inner city black folks are being criminalized and stuff. It's like, I have the experience, but like I'm in, you know, small town West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
My town is devoid of resources. My town is devoid of any economic investment. You know, I'm poor and white. Like, I, you know, I've been cheated too. Like, why are black people getting the attention, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, all these things are related. We look at neoliberalism and factories leaving some of these communities for, you know, to give businesses a better bottom line.
Yep.
You know, that relates to this idea of capitalism and kind of this resurgence of capitalism in neoliberalism in the 60s and 70s. Yeah. And then how the war on drugs was really a part of that. And how all the money from the state, you know, went to the war on drugs. We're talking trillions of dollars to this point. And that money could have been used to invest in your community. It could have been used to have job training for folks to work in those communities that you live in.
Yeah.
Right. So like all these things are connected, and maybe it's not through the salient idea of race, but it's through economic justice and economic rights and distributing resources from the state in a more equitable way that actually furthers society and gives everyone a seat at the table.
Yeah. And that's why it's important. It's being able to understand the language, and then it's being able to speak about it and use a rhetoric beneficial when talking about drugs or the use of it, and how, you know, when, you know, as more people are coming to this sort of awakening of realizing all these things, it's okay. We've realized this, and then. This is what we can do about it. On a personal level, it's like if people need help, they need help, right? And that's hands down anybody. If someone is suffering, that person needs to be alleviated of their suffering. And it's like something I can do is like, well, you know, it happened 30 years ago. What do you want me to do about it now? Sort of mentality. But it's like, okay, you're right. Happened 30 years ago, but like, what can we do to prevent that from happening? And what can we do to benefit what's going on now? It's like, we still have a lot of communities that lack trauma centers. Chicago is a great example of that. Like, and seeing then where the money is going and where it should properly be invested in. Am I making any sense?
Yeah, if they're building this first option because they had years of campaigning and activists organizing around trying to get one, like not begging, but like making them give us one.
But that is what we can continue to do as individuals. You know, we're always here at Bourbon and Bronton trying to talk about like why these things are important to be talking about. And at the end of the day, it's like what each of us can do from an individual standpoint to make some sort of change. And it's really, as always, educating yourself, you know, finding and supporting change in policy, you know, favoring treatment over criminalization, but really holding all policymakers and public officials accountable. You know, like you're saying, like when have we seen a big pharma head go to jail? Like,
right. Well, I think, I mean, again, I'm under research on this, but it's like, maybe everything they did was legal. And that's like, that's almost a bigger problem. Right. And it's like, why is this okay? And there's other examples of lobbyists, you know, being able to do this, but when it has to do with like public health, it really gets to a different moment, a different way it's different.
Yeah. And because like you see it in like the advertisements.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, like now that I'm kind of thinking about it, like we I know we talked about the smoke-free, drug-free, or cigarette-free, tobacco-free. Oh, what is it?
Truth.
Yeah. You know, we're looking at the way they advertise, and like tobacco is all of a sudden like bad and it can kill you and blah, blah, blah. But like you look at like, you know, hey, do you have anxiety? Oh, because guess what? By the way, this world is filled with people with anxiety. So of course they're going to want something to help sort of sedate that. So we're also seeing like, to another point, it's like, the system that we live in has created for people to have to even want or have a need for these sort of things, because they're also advertised like, oh, like hey, you're 16 years old and you're a little sad. Here's some antidepressants. Like, go ahead and take these. And so it's also like the ease in which people can get these things. And it's a cycle. It's always going to be a cycle.
Yeah. And my thing, especially with like, I think I mentioned that on the other podcast with Truth or with other like, hey, you're having pain, you're having anxiety, do this or treat that or, you know, looking at, you know, folks taking harder drugs really in like poor white communities now or back in the day or, you know, poor black communities, it's like, okay, like someone like needs to do crack or needs to do something. It's like, okay, like why? And like, why are they depressed? Why is like a lot of people in the same community depressed? Yeah. Like why are a lot of people in, you know, this, you know, town X in West Virginia depressed and needing something to do? Or like, why is joblessness so prevalent in this community? It's like, well, maybe like, but the factories there, like, didn't disenfranchise these communities in so many different ways. Like, maybe that's kind of the root of this issue.
Yeah.
You look at smoking, even just in Chicago, and like with the public health survey.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the place of smoking is most prevalent. It's like smoking, but it's like, okay, like, stop smoking. It's like, cool, but like, why do people have to smoke in this community so much more than others? And the question I hear, because this isn't like a people are keen to this now, but it's like, what do we do? Like, okay, we were wrong back then. We're right now. It's like, whoopsies. So, okay, like, how about you give these communities, people, like, reparations?
Yeah.
And that's, like, a buzzword. People hear that. Like, oh, we're not going to give
it. Like, what? I'm going to pay some
money. So, okay, well, like, look at how these laws, and I'm talking about not just drug laws, but housing laws, like, policing laws, all these things really just devalorize and disenfranchise these communities in, you know, 70s, 80s, and on, and before that, of course. But how about we reinvest in these communities in very, very prevalent, obvious ways, in education, in housing, in hospitals, and trauma centers?
It's just like how we talked about
ways that have been researched and statistically proven to live to a better life and better outcome.
No, and it just reminds me of the health disparities episode that we talked with Jessica, and it's really like the solution to this is equity, not equality.
Yes.
You know, and we're working in a system, in a capitalistic system, right? And so that money speaks. Money, and like where you get your money from, who's like where you're using your money are two very important things. And it's interesting that, you know, this movement, the movement of like we are the 99%. We are more than them, right? This mentality of like there's this group of people that make this much more money than the rest of all these people. And I think when I first heard it, I was like, what? Like how?
Like, it's not like a thought. It's not like a framework. It's just facts.
No, it's just like, but I'm just like, I'm like these group of people make more money than all these other people in the country. Like,
in the world.
I'm like, how much fucking money is that? How are they getting this money? Like, who the fuck is giving them this money? Because I'm not. But that's the thing. Like, I am. And it's and that's kind of like, sort of like this realization. And that's what we're constantly trying to do. Not to preach, but like, you know, just trying to expose and tell people. You know, because at the end of the day, all you guys are stuff. And you got to be able to learn and adapt to the environment around you.
Yeah.
And I want to thank everyone for joining us for another episode. At any time, you can follow us on iTunes or Google Play if you aren't already. Follow us on everything Soapbox at soapboxpo.com. Please, if you haven't already, check out our project, shy-dna.com. And then you can follow us on all social media platforms, soapboxpo, all things. Am I missing anything, Colin?
I don't think so. I don't think you wrapped it up quite well. Reparations is not a dirty word. White supremacy is not a dirty word. Use them. Use them a lot. Use them always. Drugs is not simplistic and binary. It's nuanced.
Yeah.
And treatment is great, but let's not let this keep happening. People are making these laws. We are making these laws. We're electing people to make these laws.
You got to play into the electoral. And as always, though, stay black, stay brown, stay queer.
Stay tuned, stay turned.
We out. How we stop the Black Panthers? Ronald Reagan cooked up an answer. You hear that? What Gil Scott was hearing when our heroes and heroines got clipped on heroin crack. Raise the murder rate in D.C. and Maryland. We invested in that. It's like we got Merrill Lynch. And we've been hanging from the same tree ever since. Sometimes I feel the music is the only medicine. So we cook it, cut it, measure it, bag it, sell it. The fiends cop it. Nowadays they can't tell it. That's that good shit. We ain't sure, man. Put the CD on your tongue. Yeah, that's pure, man. That's that crack music, nigga.